Welcome to Holden Village. This afternoon in the Creekside Room, Karen Bloomquist is speaking on economic life, the church's role. So let's listen in on Karen.
I am the director for studies in the part of the Evangelical Lutheran Church churchwide offices that is responsible for the development of the church's positions on social issues, particularly its social statements and messages. And this whole week we're focusing on the church and social issues. Yesterday we spent some time talking about moral discernment in the church. How certainly scripture is a very central part of that, but also tradition, contemporary knowledge, our own experience, how that all together becomes a part of the process. There were a number of people present yesterday who were raising, I think, some very good questions about how, you know, what the purpose of social statements is in our particular denomination, and also how social statements come about. I indicated there's a procedural document that describes some of the purpose of social statements. But for those of you who are interested, I thought I'd pass this diagram around. I had it posted outside, and there, I think, are some extra copies around. But that gives you kind of in a nutshell a sense of the various processes that are part of the development of a social statement in the ELCA. And I do have some extra copies of that up in my room that I can give to some of you who might want a copy to take with you. Today, what we want to talk about, and I do want this to be a very participatory session, is some beginning thoughts on the eventual development of a social statement focused on some crucial current issues related to economic realities or economic life. I'm going to pass this particular brochure around because it will become a guide for some of the questions that we'll want to discuss. This is a process that is just barely getting underway. A task force has been appointed by our board, names and some of the areas of expertise of the people on the task force are listed on the back. And the thinking on this is really just beginning. And the first step of this is going to be a series of listening posts in about 18 different areas of the country. One of those 18 will be in Texas, knowing that there are a number of Texans here. And those of you from other parts of the country may want to check on some that might be in your area. The idea is that there's not a draft, there's not any kind of document to react to, but two or three of us connected with the work on this particular social statement are going to be spending two or three days in various parts of the country listening to people, listening to what the economic realities are that people experience in different parts of the country, and how those issues are being addressed, how people are connecting those issues or not connecting those issues with what the church should be about or what their Christian faith is all about. And so trying to put our ear to the ground, we've done this actually in connection with some of the other processes also early on. This is probably a bit more developed way that we're trying to do this. And so before we even settle in on what particular aspects of economic life are going to get primary emphasis in this social statement, we're wanting to do some careful hearing across the life of the church. And so in different places around the country, people have been asked to pull together various groups for us to meet with and talk with. And that, quite frankly, is what I want to spend the majority of this session today about too. But before we get into that kind of open discussion, and you might want to just be thinking now, what are some of the economic issues in you know, where I live, where I come from, maybe some of the issues that are impacting you personally, or at least those around you, in terms of some of the questions and the issues that people are dealing with. Before we get into that discussion, though, I want to just say a few things about why a social statement focused on economic life. Back in 88, when the ELCA came into being, we were asked to develop a plan for what some of the major areas of social statement should be early on in the life of the ELCA. And one dealing with economic life, although under various labels, was kind of on the docket from the very beginning. Because I think the surveys we did at that point, and just in terms of looking at what are the major issues that impact our society and impact the world, economic concerns are hard to avoid. I think theologically there is clear basis for why a church needs to be dealing with and looking at economic realities. Certainly there is far more concern around economic issues addressed in Scripture, for example, than just about any other topic. Many passages that talk about have some rather sharp things to say about greed, about worshiping of idols, and we might think immediately of how the almighty dollar becomes an idol in some very real ways in our society. Certainly, the plight of the poor, questions of distribution of the resources that God has given to us, and how those are, how those are distributed. Lots of issues of economic justice that are very prevalent in different portions of Scripture. And so certainly to understand what God's activity is about in our world today, what God's providence is all about, how God is involved in an ongoing way with the care of creation, there's no question that the economic questions loom rather large in that whole consideration of what is at the heart of our faith. Last week I was doing a session on God's economy, and I want to just share with you who weren't there just a few things I shared from this particular book, God the Economist by Douglas Meeks. He's a theologian who has done a rather interesting kind of study of, first of all, the way in which we might reimagine God as an economist and look at the way in which God's activity is talked about in Scripture in terms of God as a householder or as the manager of the household, and thinking of the whole world as God's household, and how a lot of the activity of God's priorities and how that gets lived out in creation, in the world, is a prominent kind of theme throughout Scripture. One of the things that Meeks does is to contrast, for example, how the market economy and the logic of the market economy is quite different from God's economy. God's economy, God's concern, is that all have access to that which gives life, all having access to livelihood and distribution of God's resources are therefore is a prominent kind of focus. The importance of sufficiency for all, enough to go around, that in some very real ways is at the center of what Meeks refers to as God's economy. And to separate who we are as Christians, therefore, from our life as economic beings, from how we live out our lives in relationship to economic realities, to separate ourselves from that and say, well, that's, you know, that's how, that's money, and that's somehow separate from our religious life, is in a sense to deny God's providence, God's reign, God's involvement with the whole of what creation is all about. And I think another way of thinking about this is to think of a number of words that I'm going to put on the board. Words that are very religious kinds of words. But as I'm putting these up here, I want you to think about where you're likely to hear these words in addition to the church. See those words come popping up. Words like trust, fidelity, promissory, redemption, debt, saving, futures.
Loan.
Stock market.
Loan application.
Stock market.
Banks.
Loan application. Banks.
Banks.
Savings. And if a bank has a name, or a bank or an investment has a name like Fidelity.
Savings and trust.
How does that make you feel? Does the label make you feel a bit more confident?
Not
that
anymore.
Not anymore. It becomes a little bit cynical or suspicious of the way the words might be used to market something.
You might as well call the bank and buy some bonds, and the response was, are they for redemption or conversion? Because is this the First National Bank, First Baptist Church?
I think that's just one example of how a lot of the language that clearly is religious language has in a sense been appropriated and becomes a part of what we associate with banking, finance, the markets, and you know the kind of language that that has carried over from one realm to another. So the first point I want to make is that concern for how economic relationships are lived out and for what happens to people through the economy is not a peripheral concern, but is a rather central concern for the life of faith, and is a very central concern reflected in so much of Scripture. Secondly, economics has to do with a rather significant, and some say an ever-spreading span of our life. It has to do with our livelihood, with how we value things. I am amazed and am constantly catching myself with realizing how much the market logic determines the value I place on things. Well, let's see, now that must not be worth as much as this because, you know, it costs less or this or that, or, how we spend our time, whose time is more valuable than whose. What is the exchange value of something? And then the endless repetitive patterns of consumerism that becomes in many cases, an all-absorbing occupation of many family units, both making the money to buy the consumer goods and the kind of vicious circles that we get caught up in. I remember the story some years ago of a man who, you know, was working two or three jobs, you know, sacrificing that time away from his family because he was bound and determined to earn the money in order to buy that big boat that he could enjoy with his family. And of course, by the time he finally acquired the boat, then he still had the bills to pay. So, you know, it was a kind of self-defeating circle because the bills kept going higher and higher. So he had to work more and more to pay off the boat. And, you know, the hope that somehow this would be the leisure kind of access to leisure that he'd spend, you know, use it for leisure time with his family tended to disappear in the midst of the constant cycle of trying to pay for more and more consumer goods. The way in which so much of our life and sometimes people themselves are treated like commodities, the kind of bottom line thinking that can take over, you know, what's the bottom line? And I think at times that even occurs in the church in terms of what logic or what we really operate with. And the way in which economic realities deeply affect a lot of the personal issues that we face. One of my desires from the beginning of trying to move into the social statement, and this has really been one we've been wanting to get started on for 3 or 4 years now, is that family, work, and community is in many ways a helpful lens for getting into these issues. If we begin to ask ourselves, what are some of the crunches that we feel in family life? Particularly in family life where more and more families are realizing or feeling they need two incomes in order to make ends meet, and then somehow that still doesn't seem to make ends meet, and then there's all kinds of other issues arise that arise that way. The changing reality of work and the fact that young people entering the workforce today are probably not at all going to have the experience that people who've been in the workforce for a few decades have had, namely that, well, you kind of can count on there being security with that company for the rest of your life or for a long time. Predictions that people will change careers probably many times in their life, and probably some of you have experienced some of those changes yourself, and we might want to talk about the economic and other impact of that. So changing realities of work, you know, including who the workers are, with predictions that by the middle of the next century, there will be probably a minority of workers will be, you know, white Anglo males, which was certainly the predominant workforce the middle of, you know, the present century. So shifting faces as to who is a part of the workforce. And probably one of the overwhelming realities, and I think the task force has already early on identified this as a backdrop against which a lot of these issues need to be considered, is the fact that we live in what is pervasively a global market economy today, where national companies that you say, well, they're committed to what happens in our country, et cetera, you know, those companies are starting new plants in this country or that, and, you know, wherever the profitability is going to be the greatest. Some of you may be familiar with this rather interesting book, The Work of Nations, by Robert Reich, who now is the Secretary of Labor, but has a number of provocative ideas of what's happening in terms of corporations and in terms of the workforce in this country, and, you know, basically saying that national borders no longer matter when you're talking about economic realities. I sense those of you living in at least the southern part of Texas are probably more aware of some of that than a lot of us in other parts of the country are. And so I think, you know, how we understand those realities, how we draw on understandings of our faith, how we think ethically and come up with some principles that can guide us in looking at those issues in our day is certainly part of what we're hoping the eventual social statement might be helpful. Not in terms of nailing down all kinds of specific positions, but trying to test out and develop some principles, some perspectives that can become, as I was saying yesterday, some basic parameters within which we as people of faith look at those economic realities and offer one another some guidance, recognizing that individuals and, you know, continue to work with those principles, and there's a kind of freedom of the conscience and certainly having to hone in on those as to how they apply to specific questions and issues. But how can we be more helpful in providing guidance as we think through those issues and how we live them out in our daily life? So I want that's kind of a preface to get us into some discussion. I'd be willing, before we open it up, for some discussion of the economic realities that you observe or experience yourselves, I'd be open to any questions that you might have about the basic kind of premise or the starting point that I've been talking about in the last few minutes.
It's always been intriguing to me how the church or religious attitude towards money has varied over the century. I don't know that much about history, but I know a little bit that know that it wasn't very long ago that usury was a, quote, cardinal sin.
Yeah.
Now it is almost the basis of our society, and we Christians cannot really think of a life without that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any views or perspective on how that kind of change? It seems to me that is a real basis if you approach any kind of...
Well, you know, and the interesting thing is there's a quote from Luther in one of his treatises on trade and usury, where, you know, there were some very early trade practices getting started that were becoming somewhat monopolistic. The Fuggers, Fugger, was some trading monopoly that was operating in the area of where he was. Well, I think it was in northern Germany somewhere. And he, in this treatise, had some of his strongest language. I mean, normally Lutherans have thought of issues related to the economy having to do with the creation, with the realm of what we think of as the law or the left hand of the kingdom. And he, in some very fiery language in that treatise, says, you know, he uses very strong language. I can't remember the exact words, but I'll try to give you the kind of strength of his language. It was, you know, like, well, these you know, no good for nothings, they're out robbing the poor and the little fish they swallow, and they could care less about the poor people. And he goes on and on, you know, and I mean, those of you who've read some of Luther are aware that his language gets rather flowery and at times almost vulgar, but he, you know, pulls out all the stops and said, to have anything to do with these companies that, of course, you know, usury was a part of what he was condemning there. To have anything to do with them is to sacrifice the gospel. I mean, it was an issue of faith for him. I mean, it was an issue of the gospel, not just an issue of God's reign through the law, but an issue of faith. So certainly, you know, already there, and of course that was, you know, that was in a pre-capitalist kind of era, but there was some concentration of moneyed interest that was, you know, occurring at that time. You're right, certainly that's become something that we find quite acceptable.
It's a virtue now.
That's right.
Save
a little
money.
That's right. Yeah. I quite frankly don't know that much about the historical turn as to how that all changed. It's been interesting because one of the members of the task force who's from the state of Washington is very, very involved in corporate business. And one of the things that he's doing as a consultant right now is advising the Saudi Arabia government on how to set up their banking system. And he talks about the enormous challenge that is because according to Muslim law, thou shalt not charge interest. And so it's a really interesting challenge that he's dealing with and learning a lot about that culture and especially how much, the religious traditions have a hold on what you can or cannot do in that particular country. Other questions about what I've said or perhaps what I've not said thus far? What I'd like to do then is to use our remaining time as a kind of preliminary listening post. I said we're going to have some listening posts in different parts of the country, but I'm going to erase what's on the board and do some jotting down of some of the economic realities that are key in your life, in your community, or in society as you perceive it. Some of you may want to look in this little brochure. I'm really asking question number one. You're free to take these with you because if you don't get everything out that you want me to hear, you might want to jot it down and give me the form later on in the week. What are some of the economic realities that strike close to home for you or at least are some key factors in the area where you live?
I am among other things, a Texas rancher, and one of those that seemed to make lots of national news last year. A producer of mohair in our area of Texas, we raise Angora goats, and the whole question about the wool and mohair subsidy, which goes back for years and years and years, became sort of a political ball, and since we had the smallest pack around, and it was kind of an exotic industry, the powers that be chose to say that we could very easily do without that subsidies, and as a result that has been cut. But the whole question in agriculture of government involvement and how much do we need the support of the society as a whole to continue our particular profession.
Okay, certainly that's a key issue in other parts of the country too.
I don't know how directly this addresses that particular question, but one of the things that really disturbs me in our society is the definition of poverty. definition of poverty.
Poverty.
We talk about the poverty level and how many people are living below the poverty level, and how many families the mother has to work to make ends meet. And I know in other parts of the world, our poverty level would be a life of unimaginable luxury for some people. And as a child of the Depression, I have very deeply ingrained in me to use it up, wear it out, make do or do without. And our culture and society today has no concept of that kind of style of living. And it seems to me like we in the church can just to diminishing our materialistic attitudes. And I'm not quite sure how this can be accomplished, but to encourage a realization that we don't all have to have two cars and a boat and three TVs, et cetera, et cetera. When we consider the, we're getting into a global economy we're quite, you mentioned South Texas there, the influx of Hispanics there completely changed the labor and economic structure of a lot of that.
I put these both up here, although I want us to bracket the fact that I think there's some built-in tensions here too.
Absolutely.
Because certainly, you know, generally, for example, welfare and other assistance programs in many cases do not even bring people up to what is seen as poverty level. Certainly in Chicago, I'm aware of that those who are poor are doing a lot with less in some ways that you know, are beyond my comprehension at times.
Well, this is what I have no feel for, is, like I say, as a child of depression, I was not responsible for it. I was 10, 12 years old. My father took a sabbatical without pay to work on a degree, and it was every nickel, every penny. Mm-hmm. And we did without a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And when I see, I cannot relate to these people today. How diligently do they? They don't know how to do that.
I'm going to put something else up here because I think certainly you've pointed to, I think, some generational differences, you know, and how it would be very interesting if we had the time to go around and talk about how our own upbringing affected our view of economic reality. That's what you're really
talking about. Getting married and what we started out with, what my kids did, you know, it just, they were a couple steps ahead of us.
And you see, now there's a whole other interesting part of that cycle that's beginning to emerge. There's some books being written now of how the sons and daughters of people who did make it fairly well, say in the 50s and 60s, are now finding that they are falling short of, in other words, that they, if anything, are falling behind where their parents were because the opportunities aren't there because getting ahead, being able to afford a house, you know, these are many of the 20, 30-year-old kinds of kids who are moving back home, which at least when I was growing, my goodness, I left home and I don't want to come back, et cetera. So new economic realities that are entering that picture with the sons and daughters of those who did achieve some affluence, say, after World War II, maybe didn't become rich, but at least, you know, made a life for themselves in some way. How do we understand, you know, so those generational differences and where you fall on that and how the economic developments affect your whole outlook and your whole way of, your whole value system and what it is that you're, quote, working for, unquote. Some other voices. Over here.
I know that we're talking about our realities as it relates to people working in the United States. But to me, the most immoral thing that the United States is doing right now is what we're doing to the third world. And this is mostly through the World Bank. And we right now are getting payments to the World Bank from the blood of little children. it's actually literally that thing in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
We're demanding that these people pay back the loans that they got years ago. We're demanding that they pay back at a rapid rate. And we're demanding that they tear down all of their social structure, all of their clinics for children, schools for children, all of the things that make life livable for very poor people. We're demanding that they stop all of that. We just demanded a couple of years ago that Mexico dismantle their system, and they did. And they've had to do that. But when we talk about, when you read about democracy in the newspaper, democracy does not have the same meaning now that it had when I was 25 years old. When I was 25 years old, democracy was a very nice thing where everybody got to vote. But now democracy means a system that's based on the bottom line. It has nothing to do with voting at all.
Want to say more about that last point?
Democracy is really our word in the newspapers for capitalism. And the reason I say that is that we've gone into countries that were where democracy was well defined, where people voted whenever they wanted to, had regular elections and so forth, and we said we brought them democracy, and what we brought them was capitalism. The worst part of capitalism, where we destroyed the social systems that were systems that people like Roosevelt considered essential to a poor nation.
And I think especially in the 80s, I mean, the first of what you were talking about, the way in which I remember being at a hearing with representatives from the World Bank and the IMF in Berlin, you know, with various citizens groups from around the world, you know, just incredibly stark stories about what, in fact, the paying back of the debt that they owed, what the impact of that was in terms of some of those services, as well as crops being grown primarily for export, and the people themselves not having the food they needed.
I guess you'd hear in my area, people say, well, you know, if I borrow money from the bank, I've got to pay it back. And doesn't the same principle work? Why should our government loan money or the World Bank and call it a loan and it's not going to be paid back? Doesn't make good economics. And it also causes them to be dependent, kind of money going down the drain. That'd be the answer you get in my area.
But in most cases in the third world, this money that was loaned to those countries either disappeared in the Swiss banks or was used for military expenditure.
Well, that's
mostly
that's another question.
It was mostly to maintain tyrants in office.
Yeah, that's the whole new dimension we're talking about. I mean, you condemn the bank for wanting the money back. Why did they make the loans?
Well, I don't blame the banks. I blame the people of the United States for allowing them to get this money back more rapidly by eliminating children's health.
That's just one.
Okay, let's move on to some other. Dale, you've been on.
Well, actually, I'd like to add to that. For those people who are sort of aware of what's happening in the third world and the manipulation of debt, and how devastating that is. There's a parallel in the United States that we sort of don't even realize, is that the same manipulation of debt, so to speak, and we don't pay back our own national debt.
We're the biggest debt in the nation, right?
That's right. And as a result of that, I mean, so much of our energy goes into paying the national debt that we don't realize that when we're paying that sort of money out in payments to our own debt, we ourselves are sacrificing our own social structures. We're sacrificing health care, and we're saying, I mean, it's obvious for years, we've been sacrificing schools. And we are equally chained to debt as the third world is. It's destroying our own social structure.
Yet the ELCA came out with a statement that was opposed to a balanced budget to reduce this debt.
No, there was a resolution that was passed that was in opposition to having that as a constitutional amendment. Not saying that debt shouldn't be reduced, but what happens if you have an artificial mechanism of, you know, requiring that there be a balanced budget in terms of some of the social needs that therefore could be jeopardized in relationship to that. I agree, that's a controversial issue. Should there be a balanced budget?
Yeah, I mean, amendment? We're talking out of both sides of the mouth.
Yeah, no, but the point of that was not that there shouldn't be, that it wouldn't be good to have, that we don't, yes, we need to reduce the debt. The question is, should there be a constitutional amendment requiring that there always be a balanced budget in order to address that problem? Okay, I see each of these, we can get in a big discussion. So I'm going to ask us to try to get some other economic realities up there that aren't without getting in too much of a discussion of each
welfare place. Reform.
Okay.
The church's position on that ought to be qualified. What is your attitude towards welfare? What is our responsibility?
Okay.
The church used to do a lot of that. Now we don't.
Church used to do all of it.
And there are some working principles on welfare reform that are based on the social statements of the predecessor church bodies. Those of you who might be interested in that, let's just have a copy of that. Other issues?
Yeah, I spent the last 4 years in a rural community in Iowa, and I'm not a farmer, but having lived in that community and heard the issues in that community, I get the sense that, at least in rural America, and probably almost everywhere, there's sort of this sense of the lack of control over your own economic life. Mm-hmm. That it used to be, say, for farmers that, you know, if you worked a little longer, put in a few more hours, that you were going to make it. People have seemed to reach a sense of despair over that, is that no longer will additional hours or getting a little more help from the boys make it, because your economic life is controlled and is in the hands of those who buy your product and who control your debt.
Yes, but look at the Amish. Beautiful farms. They don't take subsidies. They still live under the previous system. It's when the farmers started getting involved with the government subsidies that they lost control. And it's a trade-off.
Well, it seems to me, if it's back to that first question I raised, that usury, are we a credit? We have really changed, you know. My father would not go into debt unless he just answered that. I mean, that was almost a sin. You paid as you went. Now, we're a credit-based economy. You just can't do anything without a credit. So, have we really looked at what that has done, the whole question of easy credit? Farmers and ranchers can't really function nowadays without buying out. Getting lots of credit. It's not just government, but it's quotation credit and whatever. Mm-hmm. Is that can we change it if it isn't?
One other comment on that man's eulogy about the Amish, there's another side to it also. They need a kidney transplant for one of their children. They get it through Medicaid and other services through Medicaid. They really make use of that, and they're not contributing to it other than being cheap workforce for some of the people they work for.
Okay, I'm a hospital accountant, and I know it's being discussed now, but the whole issue of healthcare availability. And I think the hard fact that isn't really being discussed fully, that's politically, no one's had real political guts to really deal with it yet, and that's that there isn't enough money anywhere in the country to give everyone every kind of health care they want. That the only way I think ultimately to get some sort of a health care program is to include rationing of some sort, of some means. The majority, and I've forgotten the percentages, but the majority, I think, of the money spent on people's health care is in, I think I've heard, in the last month of life. And that gets to some hard decisions on how much you do and, you know, and at what point you stop it and who makes the decisions to stop and all those kinds of things. But you're not going to get the money dealt with until you get into those issues.
I think that's a very critical and very interesting example of the how, even though as Christians we'd say you don't put an economic value on human life,
you're
and yet when you're dealing with the kind of expensive measures, high tech kinds of measures, there, by the way, there is an end of life message that a couple of years ago the ELCA produced that deals with particularly some of those questions. That doesn't really deal with the economics of it, but you know, questions like physician-assisted suicide and you know, when to pull the plug kinds of questions and living will and those kinds of issues. That actually Barbara Sittler's an authority on those and was doing those questions and was doing a series on that last week. Okay, I think certainly the reason there is. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why this has become a predominant debate in Congress right now, but I think the economics of health care, in a way that 30 years ago, I don't think we would have probably seen that as such a huge driving force in our economy in the way that it clearly is today. Other
education as it relates to people's ability to work in this world.
Okay. Education.
Because of the changing world,
right.
And I don't think we've really figured out what kind of education we need to be going forth with.
Or what kind of jobs, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's certainly the where Reich really puts his emphasis, that it's probably can't do a lot about the fact that companies are going to continue relocating. But how can we somehow educate and equip the workforce to be there with the kinds of skills that are going to be needed? I think it's a huge, huge challenge.
Nobody's mentioned the flight of industry yet. And to me, this is the most important thing in the United States today as an economic problem.
Is it flight or flight?
Flight.
Into other countries.
We even have a euphemistic word now. We use the word offshore, and they mean by offshore overseas. Mm-hmm. Offshore makes people think that it's something like one of those oil rigs up in the Santa Barbara Channel. But they're talking not about the Santa Barbara Channel, but China, for instance. And we've been gradually selling off our industrial base, the big steel mills and so on. And our justification of these companies is that they're not making enough money. But the purpose of industry is not to provide money as a bottom line, but to provide jobs for people. If we're going to have a strong country, we have to have high employment.
Tell that to your stockholders.
Yes.
I mean, you can't serve the people and not return an investment to your stockholders.
That's why we need to change the system.
And the stockholders will invest in the foreign companies, right?
Sure.
The more the investments.
Industry cannot operate at a deficit. Only the government can do that.
But I'm not talking about deficits. They closed down those plants back east because they're only making something like 7%.
You mentioned bottom line. But that's what I'm talking about. A deficit is the bottom line, a negative bottom line.
I would also be interested to hear from any of you who are, you know, working within the world of business these days, because at least my sense is that doing business in a global market economy is an increasingly tough, complicated kind of challenge. You know, some of the issues, pressures. I mean, obviously, some of those relate to some of the economic and environment kinds of tensions. care for the environment, but one of the reasons that our unit is initially framing this as a social statement on economic life—not that that's necessarily going to be the title of it—is we really want to look at that whole expanse of economic life. Certainly as church grounded in scripture, there's no question that there needs to be some real priority of what happens to the least of our brothers and sisters. In other words, those who end up being on the lower end of things, whether in this country or in other countries of the world. But we also want to give some serious attention and not have voices of business people who are also members of our church to feel somehow, well, they're not really dealing with my concerns. I mean, that's why we intentionally have people from the world of business, including some very, really high levels of business, on the task force. What are some of the questions, some of the issues, maybe some of the business ethics challenges that the world of the people involved in business are facing today that maybe are new questions or issues that are a bit different from what they used to be?
I can speak somewhat for the petroleum industry. In fact, well, I worked for Major Holcomb Amoco for many years, and my experience was that no time was I ever asked to compromise my faith, beliefs, or ethical standards for any reason. And I felt that this was the policy of the company, though I was not high enough to know whether that was actually always carried out. I know they do have an increased sense these days, from what I read, of environmental consciousness and social consciousness, too. But that hasn't kept them from causing a great deal of grief amongst their employees in my area, because they have practically shut down the domestic exploration and gone to international, simply because they're two reasons. The government has restricted their access to whatever remains to be found. And secondly, well, that's principally, if we're going to find more minerals for our use, it has to be elsewhere because we've just about exhausted our domestic supplies. So they're forced by the realities of the earth to go elsewhere. But We've made some deals with the Russians to expand or exploit their fields. They have practiced Russia is in a turtle shape. If you read the National Geographic and see what the communists have done environmentally, that country is just devastating. It's just, so anyone going in there will have to recognize not only, they're putting themselves in danger, as it was, exposing themselves to radiation and heavy mineral contamination and so forth and so on. So it's just, but it's all part of this global market economy that some of these companies, just as you say, they go to Mexico because the labor's cheaper and they can make more money at it. Our company is going to worldwide because that's where the product that they're trying to exploit. Highly controversial.
They're also going to those countries because our environmental problems. They don't have the environmental
problems.
Right, they
don't have the restrictions.
There are oil companies operating in the rainforests of South America right now that are dumping oil right on the ground.
Our time is almost up, but let me at least give an opportunity, particularly to those of you who haven't spoken, to add something here to the list that we